Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. If I say psychedelics, what comes to your mind?
Feeling my connection to the universe.
College.
I think about my friend. He dropped acid and went to the Philadelphia Zoo and got really scared in the nocturnal animals section.
And of course,
the 60s and hippies and maybe a Grateful Dead concert.
I think of the hippie era.
Mushrooms, tie-dye t-shirts, Woodstock,
The Doors, drug music.
Counterculture, rebels, and far-out art. But a few years ago, I started hearing about psychedelics in a totally different context, as treatments for mental illnesses like depression.
Started in a couple of minutes here.
In 2014, I visited a ketamine clinic for the first time to observe how this psychedelic, quote, party drug, also known as Special K, was being used to treat very serious depression.
So what happens next?
Angela, who's the nurse, will come in just a moment. She'll start an intravenous line.
I watched as psychiatrist Stephen Levine talked to his patient, Lynn Bates.
And you mentioned before a little bit of nerves heading into that.
Lynn had been dealing with depression for years, and she told me the first time she did this treatment, it felt like a journey into her brain, and she cleared out all the bad stuff.
And I felt joy, you know, like it was clear and bright lights, you know, bright white. It was amazing, really amazing.
This treatment still felt controversial back then. Like, I wasn't even sure if I should cover it. Critics were calling it experiments on humans without any oversight. This was just about 5 years ago. But now I'm seeing a new wave of research on psychedelics.
We really are on a renaissance. And there's more psychedelic research in therapeutic contexts going on now than at any time that there has ever been in the past.
That's Rick Doblin. He's the founder of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS. Psychedelics exist in nature, and they've been recreated in labs, so I asked Rick for a definition.
Psychedelic is a word that was invented by Humphrey Osmond in the late 1950s, and it means mind manifesting. So basically, things that bring feelings and thoughts from the unconscious into the conscious awareness. Dreams are psychedelic, meditation can be psychedelic, but generally it's come to refer to drugs like LSD, psilocybin from mushrooms, mescaline from peyote, ayahuasca, a tea from South America, drugs that promote a certain kind of weakening of the sense of self and often have been used for thousands of years for religious and healing and spiritual purposes.
And now therapists and scientists are trying to tap into those healing powers. And it seems like psychedelics have really arrived in mainstream research labs. On today's show, we're taking a look at what's happening with psychedelics research and their role in therapy. I asked Rick Doblin how psychedelics can be used to treat mental health issues, and he gave the example of post-traumatic stress disorder.
What happens when somebody has PTSD is that the traumas that they've experienced in the past color how they see the present. It's almost like they get stuck on this fearful experience that they can't really move past, they can't really integrate it. It starts to appear in their nightmares. They are hypervigilant for things that remind them of the trauma, and they become increasingly debilitated.
Rick says MDMA, a synthetic hallucinogen, also often referred to as ecstasy, can help.
What MDMA does when used with supportive psychotherapy is it brings these memories of the trauma to the surface, but it reduces the fear reaction that people have to that. We know that MDMA reduces activity in the amygdala, where we process fear. MDMA enhances activity in the prefrontal cortex, where we think logically. And MDMA increases connectivity between the hippocampus and the amygdala, where We would be processing memories from short-term to long-term memory.
MDMA also stimulates oxytocin. This is often called the love hormone. It promotes bonding and makes you feel closer to those around you.
What you have basically is a cluster of pharmacological experiences that MDMA catalyzes that help people to get out of patterns that they've been stuck in, sometimes for decades. There's Vietnam vets who recently have worked with MDMA and gotten past the trauma that they've had since Vietnam. So it's a remarkable tool when used in a therapeutic setting.
And in those settings, do people take psychedelics regularly, take them a few times, and then have sort of a breakthrough? How does this usually work?
These are completely different from the classic psychiatric drugs, where the model is that you take these drugs without therapy and you take them every day for months or years or decades. Psychedelics are not about trying to suppress the symptoms. They're about trying to get to the root of the problems and work through them with the goal of helping people be without drugs. It's a 3.5-month treatment process during which people get MDMA only three times, once a month.
People have therapy sessions before they take MDMA and then several sessions afterwards to process.
And so it's very much embedded in a psychotherapeutic process. And what our hope is, and what has turned out for most people, is that after the treatment, they don't need more MDMA and they don't need medications.
So when a study is happening, where do the psychedelics come from? Like, how do you get your hands on them?
Well, everything is very heavily regulated by the Drug Enforcement Administration. And so we have the MDMA manufactured in England, and then it's shipped to the United States for encapsulation. And all of this is controlled by police authorities. The research that's being done with psilocybin is not actually using mushrooms, but they're using synthetic psilocybin, also produced in England. It's a challenge to get plant-based materials standardized enough for the FDA to accept them as research tools. So in general, these drugs come from laboratories that are licensed by the police regulatory authorities, and very rigorous tracking of how they are shipped around the world and controlled in the safes and the alarm systems at every site.
So that sounds like sort of the exact opposite of what you think of when you think psychedelics. You think of some shady dude who cooked something up in his garage. Right?
Well, yes, it's totally not that at all. And we are trying to replace people's associations that these are medicines. These can be profoundly healing.
What are some of the challenges that stand in the way of really understanding the power of these drugs?
The first challenge has been just getting permission to do research. The National Institute of Mental Health, the last time they funded psychedelic research was 1966. In 1970, the Controlled Substances Act was passed in the United States, criminalized all the psychedelics. The U.S. was much more powerful in the world, and we were able to export our drug policy all over the world, and we were able to block psychedelic research. It was an incredible example of cultural amnesia, because in the 50s and 60s, psychedelic research was one of the most important areas of psychiatric research and of neuroscience.
Is this reminiscent of what happened with marijuana in some way, where it took a lot of research and a lot of years to then see a lot of change?
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, I think we actually need to think about it as a 50-year process, where psychedelics really came into popular consciousness in the 1960s. And then there was a massive backlash, and it's taken us 50 years to really have the culture evolve and get more comfortable working with these substances and seeing them more as tools. When you start doing the medical research, then you start getting more scientific, balanced information about the risks and benefits in a particular context. And so now that we're doing that sort of balanced research with psychedelics, I think we will also see that people's attitudes about these substances may actually change, somewhat similar to what's been happening with marijuana.
That's Rick Doblin. He heads an organization called MAP,
labs. They do psychedelics research. And attitudes are changing. One psychedelic drug has already made it through the FDA approval process, ketamine, which I mentioned earlier. Last year, the FDA approved a nasal spray called esketamine for people with treatment-resistant depression. The spray is the first new treatment for serious depression in decades. What's different about this drug, and what does its arrival actually mean for patients? Reporter Claire Tai went to find out.
Clarice Honensberg is in her kitchen and pulls something out of her cabinet. She's been taking ketamine for about a year to treat her depression.
So I usually take two of these a day, and I just dissolve it in my mouth, either buccally or sublingually.
What's buccally?
Between the gum and,
like in the side.
Yep, exactly. And supposedly it's better absorption. And you can even feel one. They're like kind of cookie feeling.
Every 4 to 6 weeks, Clarice gets infusions at a ketamine clinic in New York City. In between those visits, Clarice takes small doses of ketamine at home. Clarice has had depression for over 30 years, and her search for the right treatment has been a long one.
I mean, I've been on antidepressants since I was in my late teens. And like every class of antidepressants, and more than one antidepressant in each class. I've been on so many drugs and so many combinations of drugs. And some of the side effects were prohibitive.
Before ketamine started being used for depression, there were five other classes of antidepressant drugs. Each class works differently, but they all target the same neurotransmitters: serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. Neurotransmitters send signals to different receptors in the brain, and these three are heavily involved in regulating things like sleep, pleasure, and mood. For Clarice, none of the drugs that target those neurotransmitters worked in the long term.
I don't think I ever didn't feel suicidal. That was always in the back of my head.
Then, a year ago, Clarice had a ketamine infusion for the first time. It started working immediately.
I'm really steady right now, steadier than I ever have been, which is remarkable and amazing, and I love it.
The first person to treat depression with ketamine was Dennis Charney. He is a psychiatrist and dean of the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai.
Oh yeah, hi, we're here for Dr.
I went Charney. To see him on New York City's Upper East Side. In the late 1990s, Dennis and his research partner, John Crystal, were studying some of the existing antidepressants.
And it was known that they worked by affecting two neurochemical systems, the serotonin system and the norepinephrine system.
The thinking behind this approach was that an imbalance in serotonin, norepinephrine, or dopamine was the cause of depression. Those are compounds called monoamines. So scientists call this idea the monoamine hypothesis. Prozac, Effexor, and Wellbutrin are just some of the drugs that target monoamines. But drugs that target serotonin and norepinephrine took a long time to start working. For some patients, like Clarice, they never worked.
So we determined that we ought to look for another neurochemical system to develop a better treatment. And ultimately, we concluded we ought to study the glutamate system.
Glutamate is another neurotransmitter, like serotonin and norepinephrine. It's associated with cognition, emotion, and memory. Dennis Charney says that ketamine blocks glutamate receptors, so he and John decided to try treating their depression patients with ketamine. The first time their patients used ketamine, they started feeling better within a few hours.
We were surprised because there had never been an antidepressant drug developed that worked right away. We thought we might be onto something.
Scientists don't yet fully understand the precise areas of the brain that are critical to the antidepressant effect. But the fact that ketamine works was a big deal. And it was a new option for people who hadn't found relief with other treatments. But ketamine was not widely available because it wasn't covered by insurance. The arrival of the nasal spray changes that. It's FDA approved and covered by insurance. But it still may not catch on. For a few reasons. For starters, you can only get the spray at a doctor's office. Here's Clarice again.
I mean, they have all these crazy restrictions that I think kind of makes it prohibitive for patients.
For example, people can't pick it up at a pharmacy.
Esketamine will actually be distributed to the clinic or to the doctor and not directly to patients.
That's Michael Grunbaum, a psychiatrist at Columbia University Irving Medical Center.
While, you know, you administer it in a very quick spray, it takes a couple hours or so for patients to recover from the spaciness that is the common side effect.
The esketamine nasal spray also doesn't change the price tag that much. It's still expensive to get. Because treatments are offered in doctor's offices and monitored by staff, they can cost a few $100s to a few $1,000s each visit. Michael says the next breakthrough in ketamine treatment would be a pill.
If new medications that can be taken, you know, in a pill form at home and without all of the safety headaches of either IV or nasal ketamine, that will be a major game changer.
That story was reported by Claire Tai. This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about psychedelics and how they are being used to treat mental health issues. There's a lot of research happening right now. The pace is picking up. A few therapies seem to be headed toward FDA approval. But many people are leery of psychedelics as treatment because they remember some dark chapters in psychedelics research.
A shocked nation heard about hundreds of covert operations.
For example, top-secret CIA experiments like MKUltra, Project Bluebird, Project Artichoke. These were mind-control programs conducted at the height of the Cold War. In some experiments, the CIA used LSD, peyote, and mescaline to manipulate people's mental states.
Using American soldiers as subjects.
The CIA also backed research that was not covert, like the work of Harris Isbell in Lexington, Kentucky. Isbell did experiments on incarcerated black men. He wanted to test how much LSD somebody could tolerate and for how long. He would give people LSD doses for 77 days in a row. Experiments like this led to public distrust in psychedelic research, especially in black communities. And that distrust continues to impact research today. A recent study found that 82% of participants in psychedelic studies were white. Some researchers are pushing for these studies and the whole field to be more inclusive, especially since psychedelic-assisted therapy could be used to treat trauma in communities of color. Steph Yin has more.
When Ife Tayo Harvey was just 4 years old, her dad was sentenced to 15 years in prison. An undercover cop had propositioned him to sell cocaine, and as a new immigrant working to support his family, he accepted. He served 8 years, then was deported back to Jamaica.
This shaped my childhood experience in a way that's hard to explain, because things like this aren't supposed to happen, right?
Throughout her childhood, Ife Tayo often felt sad or angry towards herself. She had trouble trusting people.
I was really confused about what had happened with my dad and who he was as a person. I dealt with depression and anxiety and suicidal thoughts.
Her dad's absence had an effect on the whole family. Ife Tayo's mom raised 7 kids on her own. Later, one of her brothers also ended up going to prison for a crime Ife Tayo believes he didn't commit.
When you send one person to prison, you send their family, you send their communities.
In college, Ife Tayo learned about psychedelics as a therapeutic substance. She was a senior, feeling depressed and struggling to graduate. She decided to give it a try. She took some shrooms, then went on a walk with a friend through the woods of Western Mass. It was fall in New England, the woods wearing their most stunning colors. At first, it was overwhelming.
As soon as they started to kick in, I got really scared and I was like freaking out a little bit and I ended up vomiting.
But once that passed,
I definitely felt like I was alive again. Because before I just felt really dull and lifeless and numb and just like not really motivated to live at that point.
She saw life all around her.
I saw plants breathing. I saw things move and sparkle in ways that I hadn't seen before. And I also felt just like spiritually connected to the earth in a way that I haven't had. I got a reset and I needed that to be able to graduate.
Shrooms have helped Ife Tayo heal and process a lot of the trauma she and her family went through.
I've been able to look at myself with more compassion, look at my family with more compassion, when you're in a sober state of mind, it's harder to process heavy things sometimes because we want to run away from it, or we want to bury our feelings, or we want to avoid our feelings altogether. And with mushrooms, you can't really do that. Mushrooms kind of makes you face whatever you're running away from.
That year, Ife Tayo started learning more about psychedelics and psychedelic research. And after she graduated in 2014, she was excited to get a job with the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, MAPS. When she got there, she was the only Black employee, and she felt like she didn't belong. Her feelings came to a head during a Grateful Dead show in Chicago.
I'm there. I know one Grateful Dead song. but I was offered LSD by one of my colleagues, and I partook in it, and I was having a great time.
When she and her colleagues walk out of the concert, there are deadheads everywhere.
Being wild, all up and down Michigan Avenue.
As they get closer to Grant Park, they see police putting a Black man in handcuffs.
Mind you, there's all these white folks running around, probably on drugs, selling drugs, have drugs on them, doing God knows what. The one Black guy you see at the concert is, of course, getting arrested.
Someone asked, should we stop and watch to make sure they don't mistreat him? And her other coworkers responded,
he probably did something, or you don't know what he did. Let's just keep it moving. And that to me was kind of just representative of how Black folks are seen.
This was one of many times Ife Tayo felt her white coworkers didn't seem to understand or acknowledge her experience.
It's actually kind of like, it feels like you're in a twilight zone. It's very frustrating because I believe that psychedelics can be powerful and can be healing and can do amazing things for our world, but I think that we have to be very intentional and thoughtful about how we do that.
Eventually, Ife Tayo got a new job with a nonprofit called the Drug Policy Alliance, and she co-founded a group called the People of Color Psychedelics Collective.
I really wanted to create a space that is truly open and also safe for folks of color.
The mainstream psychedelic movement is not very diverse, and there are reasons for that. Elijah Watson is a journalist who's written about what he calls the whitewashing of psychedelics. He says psychedelics originated in communities of color. Indigenous groups have used them as medicine and sacrament for thousands of years. In some cases, those traditions are alive. In other cases, they were banned or destroyed through colonization. Then, in the 1950s, a white man from the U.S. went to Mexico and participated in a Mazatec mushroom ritual.
His name was Robert Gordon Watson. He went to Mexico and he found a medicine woman named Maria Sabina, and then he took the mushrooms himself.
Maria let Robert take her picture on the condition that he keep it private. But when he got back to the U.S., he published the picture and the name of her community in a big Life magazine article
called Seeking the Magic Mushroom.
That article is credited with sparking an interest in psychedelics that caught fire across the U.S., especially within the hippie movement.
You have it emerging within countercultural music during the 60s where, you know, you're having subgenres like psychedelic rock.
Soon, Maria's community was bombarded by Westerners who wanted to hallucinate on shrooms. Local police blamed her, and people ended up ostracizing her and burning her house down. Meanwhile, in the U.S., the anti-war and Black power movements were gaining strength.
I do not want to be a part of the American pie.
Richard Nixon declared a war on drugs.
America's public enemy number one is drug abuse. In order to fight
psychedelic research came to a halt, and drugs became a reason for police to search people's homes and cars and put them in prison.
Black and brown people are more disproportionately being arrested and targeted during this still very ongoing war, quote-unquote war.
Elijah says while white people have continued to use psychedelics, Black folks have a lot of reasons to stay away from them.
My livelihood is already in jeopardy even by just smoking some weed. You know, we also see how police officers tend to treat people of color with mental illness. If I'm going to partake this substance that may make someone think that I have this mental illness and I see how cops already treat them, what's to say that they're going to treat me any differently?
Because there's so much mistrust, MAPS, the organization studying psychedelics, has had trouble convincing people of color to join their clinical trials. So a few years ago, the group reached out to a psychologist named Monica Williams. Monica is a Black woman herself, and she spent her career addressing mental health disparities. She's worked with many people who are traumatized from experiences of racism and discrimination. When someone has experienced trauma, it shatters their trust in the world and their feelings of safety, causes them to be perpetually on the lookout for danger.
So if you look at experiences of racism and discrimination, you really see the same thing happening because people are continually assaulted by, could be large things, major discriminatory experiences, could be like a lot of small things, but they're coming unpredictably, and eventually you start to fear for your own safety. And then when you try to talk about it, oftentimes it's dismissed. So you're sort of just like holding on to it and carrying it around.
Monica has trained in MDMA-assisted psychotherapy with MAPS. And she believes in its potential. She wants to make sure that the protocol treats PTSD from a wide variety of causes, that it's useful to many people.
People are able to move through their traumas with a lot less pain and a lot less fear. You know, people are making new connections in their brains and changing how they're thinking about their trauma. I don't know, I think it's like a beautiful process, really.
It's common for people to feel a sort of ego death that puts things in perspective, or to find compassion.
They're able to forgive themselves. A lot of times what keeps people stuck in PTSD is they blame themselves for the traumas that happened to them.
There are still concerns that this therapy will be hard to access once it's approved. It's a 12-week course and requires 2 therapists for protection. So it will be expensive. And there's a general need for more therapists of color. This past August, Monica helped MAPS run an MDMA training in Kentucky, specifically for therapists who work with communities of color. For Elijah Watson, the journalist who's covered the history of psychedelics, what's important about this moment is that people of color, like Monica and Ife Tayo, are speaking up. And people are listening.
If you don't have somebody who does look like you advocating for this thing that could possibly help you, yeah, you're probably not going to do it.
That story was reported by Steph Yin. We may be in a psychedelic renaissance, but using psychedelics as medicine or therapy is not new. Many indigenous cultures have long used psychedelics to address mental health issues or questions of existence. One group keeping that tradition alive is the Native American Church. They use a type of cactus called peyote as a sacrament.
It is a medicine. It's a way of life. It is part of our ancestors. It's the flesh of God. It's part of me. I am of the medicine.
That's Sander Ironrope. He lives in the Black Hills of South Dakota, and he's been part of the Native American Church his whole life.
I'm a Lakota from the Ogallala Sioux tribe.
Sandra says members of the church use peyote in ceremonies. It's thought the spirit communicates through the peyote to bring healing. Right now, the federal government only allows members of the Native American church to use peyote for their religion. But in the last year, it's been decriminalized in Oakland and Denver. In part, advocates say, to make research easier. But what does that mean for Native people?
Did they inquire about the indigenous perspective on how this would affect us, the indigenous communities who rely on these plant-based medicines?
Sandra says when you use psychedelics in a therapist's office, something is lost, and he's wary of where all of this is headed. Maybe pharmaceutical companies will try to isolate peyote's useful compounds, put it in a pill.
For indigenous people, when you engage in this medicine here, there's a spiritual component that you're calling upon. And there are the elements that you're utilizing. And if you are using it and just extracting what you want to commercialize it for medical purposes, you're missing something. And you will always be missing something.
Sandra says for now, peyote should just be left alone for future generations of his community.
We have been dealing with take. Broken treaties. What are you giving back? This peyote medicine, it's one of our last sacraments that we have, one of our last medicines. If you really respect something, sometimes you just have to leave it alone.
That's Sander Ironrope. He is a member of the Native American Church. Coming up, when psychedelics use goes wrong.
Man, it felt really scary.
Still to come on The Pulse.
Support for The Pulse comes from Select Greater Philadelphia. With over 30 cell and gene therapy development companies, Greater Philadelphia is where the field started and continues to thrive. More at discoverystartshere.com.
This is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. We're talking about psychedelics and how they are being used in therapy. We heard about how MDMA can be used to treat PTSD, post-traumatic stress. It reduces people's fear reactions, so facing a past trauma doesn't seem so scary. That same quality could make MDMA useful in couples therapy, says Brian Earp. He's one of the authors of Love Drugs, The Chemical Future of Relationships. When fear responses are reduced, people feel more free, maybe safer, to address things from their past that are affecting their relationships, or maybe difficult aspects of the relationship itself.
Relationships can also involve trauma, and they can also involve aspects that you don't want to necessarily get into with your partner, but that maybe you should, or maybe you want to be able to talk about, but don't know how to approach. And so insofar as you can create this feeling of safety and a willingness to approach otherwise difficult topics, that can be very helpful for some people in resolving those issues.
Now, I have not tried MDMA, but when people take it, do they feel lucid? Is it like I'm being me, but I'm being more open? Or does it feel like I'm drunk and I'm not entirely sure what I'm doing here?
As far as I understand it, the lower doses that are used in psychotherapy, you don't feel like you're blending into the walls. There are no dragons entering the room. You might have some subtle perceptual changes, so there might be a slight glow or a brightness to the environment around you, but you're certainly present in the experience. You are remembering the conversation you have with your partner, with the therapist, and when the effects of the drug wear off and you return to your normal waking consciousness, you will have been present throughout that whole experience, and you retain those memories, and you can then see about potentially applying the lessons from the therapy session into your ordinary life.
Yeah, talk about that, because I'm thinking, let's say we have a couple that is able to resolve a really difficult argument while under the influence of MDMA. When that wears off, don't we just go back to being who we were before and being annoying and aggressive and passive aggressive and all of those things?
What people are finding is that even just a few experiences under the influence of these drugs sometimes have transformative effects. And you might think of it as something that can happen when you have a radical change in perspective. So some people describe if you climb on top of a mountain and you look out over on the city and all of a sudden you realize, well, wow, you know, this all fits together. We're so small in the grand scheme of things. I really have a new perspective on what matters and so forth. And it's true that you can allow yourself to get caught up in the day-to-day chatter of life and forget that important experience that you had. But many people who have meaningful perspective-changing experiences, they don't want to lose hold of that insight. And so if you take measures to remind yourself of the lessons that you gained, you should be able to increase the chance that you'll be able to implement those lessons in your life. But it won't happen automatically. It requires effort and commitment.
And you found in your research that couples were already doing this, right?
We don't recommend it, but there's no doubt that it's happening. There are couples who have been, as it were, experimenting with the use of this drug for the purposes of exploring issues within their relationships. Now, MDMA is not something to be trifled with. It isn't just something that has physiological effects that fade away. It really does create an altered state of mind whereby you might be digging up some really troubling things within your own consciousness. And that should really be done with the help of somebody who is capable of taking you through the ins and outs of that without risking things getting even worse or bringing up something that maybe you aren't prepared to deal with.
Brian Earp is the Associate Director of the Yale Hastings Program in Ethics and Health Policy at Yale University and the co-author of Love Drugs, The Chemical Future of Relationships. And he just mentioned something that happens when people take MDMA, a radical change in perspective. He described it like when you're climbing to the top of a mountain and you're looking down and suddenly you see the big picture. Or maybe you see your partner's side of things more clearly. But how do psychedelics make this happen? Researchers call it cognitive flexibility. It's the same quality that some artists, innovators, or Silicon Valley types seek when they are microdosing. It's a skill that's innate, but not always nurtured. Reporter Jad Slaman looked into it, and he found that it can be boosted without drugs.
In the classic Moby Dick, an obsessed Captain Ahab hunts a white whale that had bitten off his leg. The original is written from the perspective of one of Ahab's sailors, but Judy Willis had her fifth graders rewrite it from the whale's perspective.
Ahab, get over yourself.
She reads me some excerpts.
You claim your crazy obsession to kill me is because I am the embodiment of evil. When you endanger your crew for your own cause...
The various versions of the white whale are understandably a bit miffed by Ahab's constant pursuit, like, chill out already.
At least my head contains oil that provides bright, clear, odorless flame for candles. Your head is full of savagery and ego.
Perspective shifting is part of the psychedelic experience. Users view themselves and others in a different light instead of the tried and true. Empathize. Judy has her perfectly sober students practice it to boost their cognitive flexibility. It's the ability to look at the same info or ideas in different ways, and to do so with ease. She gives me a little test to demonstrate my lack of cognitive flexibility.
What is the opposite color of black?
White.
Okay, what do cows drink?
Oh, water.
Close one. My mind, probably yours, first went to milk.
Okay, how do you spell joke?
J-O-K-E.
Perfect. And poke?
P-O-K-E.
Excellent.
I'm on a roll.
And what do you call the white of an egg?
The yolk? No, oh, Jesus, you got me.
No, but I didn't get you. I didn't. The point
she kind of those... did, but she says it's not my fault.
Because when you grew up, there was lots of associations between cow milk and white, or between rhyming words like joke, poke, and yolk. Those neural networks in your brain have been activated many, many times, which means neuroplasticity takes over or takes place.
Judy, you may have guessed, isn't your average grade school teacher. She was a practicing neurologist before switching careers, and she explains that my brain has kind of created a rut through these neural networks, activation after activation.
More myelin coating the connecting fibers, more synapses.
This process is how we learn anything, really. The proper network for whatever task or thought process gets more and more efficient over time. It's a good thing, otherwise you'd never be able to tie your shoes without saying a rhyme about bunny ears and crisscrossing a tree. But when cognitive flexibility is lost, Judy says we can get stuck in these well-worn paths even when they're not helpful.
This leads to problems like stereotyping, less flexibility in thinking and problem solving.
Judy says schools were suppressing cognitive flexibility. It's what drove her to abandon the doctor's office for her room of grade schoolers.
They were so used to having one right answer, what is the answer, that their thinking got more rigid, their response to information, their neuroplastic response over and over, the same activation, made them less flexible.
Less talking, more working. All set?
You bet.
Ready?
Yes, ma'am.
Two thumbs?
To yourself.
She was looking into classrooms in the 90s when standardized testing was taking off. Students did a lot of rote memorization, cramming for this exam or that. She found they'd often know the right answer, fill in the proper bubble, but often couldn't explain why it was right. She didn't think that was really learning. There were behavioral consequences too.
With our patterning, as the cognitive flexibility drops, we get more anxious when things are significantly changed.
In a classroom, that can be as simple as the seating arrangement getting shuffled. Now Mark sits beside you instead of good old Brian.
The brain will say, this is different, it's probably bad, and anxiety takes over.
To build the cognitive flexibility she thought would help her students, Judy figured she also had to build divergent thinking. Basically, the ability to think up as many ideas around a topic or solutions to a problem as possible without inhibition. No wrong answers.
So I'd bring in an object that was familiar, a egg beater. And we'd go around and say, this is not an egg beater, it is a...
What else could it be?
It's a kite string winder. It's a digging holes in the sand tool.
They're whimsical, almost games, but she says this exercises your cognitive flexibility, makes you use different parts of your brain, beefing up the neural back roads so that the most well-worn path isn't always the one you go down.
Their brain is developing new cross-brain networks. And with those increased connections of parts of the brain that hadn't been used together in the same pattern over and over, those little networks and roads become more active.
This is the same effect many people seek when taking psychedelics. These drugs can make us use these back roads too by inducing altered conscious states chemically. fMRI studies show patterns of brain activity shift dramatically with LSD and psilocybin. Judy tells me she took inspiration, though, from a different shortcut to something like these altered states, from jazz. You're hearing American jazz pianist Thelonious Monk. In Judy's classroom exercises, there are no wrong answers. Monk once said, "The piano ain't got no wrong notes."
That was Jed Slayman reporting. We've been talking about psychedelics and how they are being used to treat mental health issues. And part of what surprised me when I kept hearing more and more about this was that I always thought that psychedelics could cause mental health issues, like serious problems. Grant Hill looked into the idea of the bad trip.
Ever since high school graduation, my friends and I go on this annual camping trip every summer to reconnect. We descend into the woods, tell stories, sleep under the stars, and hide alcohol from state park rangers. All of this usually keeps us pretty preoccupied, but a couple years in, one of my friends, let's call him Kevin, decided he wanted to up the ante in terms of stimuli.
Yeah, so me and my friend Mark, I kind of convinced him to do acid with me because I've done it a couple times before. I thought it was really cool. I did it on a previous camping trip with a different group of people and had a really good time.
Kevin and Mark asked if the rest of us wanted to take acid too. Our response, no thanks. When it came to LSD, we'd seen the movies and heard the stories.
Utterly fantastic, utterly terrifying, utterly powerful, and utterly unpredictable.
We'd heard that psychedelics could change your outlook on life forever, and it was a coin flip as to whether that change would be a good one. The thought of having a quote-unquote bad trip disturbed me big time. What effects might it have on my still-developing psyche?
Get me out of here! Help me!
I didn't want to find out. But as for Kevin and Mark, they just went for it.
And then we're sitting there by the fire for a little bit, and then it finally starts kicking in. Kind of looking around that the leaves are kind of starting to blur around a little bit, and the colors are starting to pop.
The rest of us, content with our light beers, just talked and watched the fire.
And then all of a sudden, we're really not feeling the rest of the group vibe.
After about an hour, we noticed that Kevin and Mark were gone. Like, physically gone, wandering around the forest with a combined 3 tabs of LSD pulsing through their heads. We began to fear the worst. After all, they were now strolling through the Pinelands, home of the fabled Jersey Devil, encountering who knows what. That, combined with the summer heat and their lack of drinking water, had all the ingredients for disaster. But right as we were about to search after them, they reemerged.
And eventually everyone was like, you know, the obvious question. How was it? What'd you guys do?
Words couldn't do it justice. They wanted to show us what they saw. And since neither of them were screaming at the top of their lungs or mumbling incoherently, we went. As we walked, they pointed out trees on the path that they formed meaningful connections with along their trip. They even named a few.
Hercules tree, our fallen brother's kaleidoscope tree.
They discovered a particularly tall tree and placed their hands on its trunk, believing this transferred the tree's power into their bodies.
We finally look at each other and we're like, this is the God tree. It was awesome. And then we came back and then we see this little tiny baby tree, like maybe 50 feet away from it. We're like, this is baby energy tree. So we took the energy from the God tree and gave it to this little tree so then in years in the future it could grow up to be the new God tree.
Wow. Kevin now calls the experience spiritual, but not exactly meaningful. Once the trip ended, he was just the same as he was before, outlook and all. He never had any sort of breakthrough, and he certainly wasn't acting enlightened or anything for the rest of our time in the woods. But then a couple months later, on a different camping trip with a different group of friends, he dropped again. Same drug, same dosage.
I was just kind of getting lost, and then all of a sudden I hear an airplane or helicopter or something kind of go overhead. And then for whatever reason, I just envision like the military coming. I just imagine like missiles striking down on this one point that I'm at in the ground. And then also around that time, my one friend caught like a good 30-foot by 30-foot section of grass on fire. But like I could just feel the heat. I mean, I literally thought I was just burning alive for like a couple minutes.
What we're seeing is that so much of what is traditionally considered a bad trip is so often around set and setting.
That's Ryan Beauregard. He lives in Colorado. In 2008, he traveled to Peru to take part in a psychedelic ritual with his friends. There, he suffered what he described as a psychotic break. It lasted for 3 weeks.
I had, you know, created an internal reality that at some point just, it was like I dove through a wormhole. Man, it felt really scary.
This experience, along with his degree in psychology, drew Ryan to the Zendo Project, a team of professionals and volunteers that set up stations at concerts to help people who are having a bad time on psychedelics. Ryan now heads the team, and he says that even little things can set the mind on a bad path while tripping.
Have you cleaned your room? And have you done your homework before you go down the rabbit hole? Because these are some big and powerful substances that are going to bring up a lot.
Biologist Patrick Smith is a science writer who focuses on psychedelics. After upping his dose of LSD a few years back, he was filled with visions of his own death.
I see myself on my deathbed.
The end of the world.
I see fires glowing through the window.
His girlfriend's corpse next to him.
She starts to sputter and suffocate. I see blood slipping from her mouth pouring onto the bed.
He still lives with these images revealed to him, like a recurring nightmare. But coming down came with something he didn't quite expect, clarity.
Ultimately, my partner couldn't understand what I'd been through.
He and his girlfriend ended up separating.
And I ended up finding a community of people who understood me better. And I have many friends who I feel bring out the best of me. So overall, although this trip was extremely traumatic, it sparked changes in my life that have been overall very positive.
Ryan from the Zendo Project says that difficult experiences with drugs like LSD are complicated, and it's not uncommon for them to have a lasting effect on how you perceive the people and world around you.
I think there's so much about this like idea that psychedelics are the magic pill. But the reality is, I think they make more work for us. Like once you've pulled those veils away, you can't unsee those things.
For my friend Kevin, that change brought on by all those incoming missiles aimed squarely at his face was actually a good one. Better, even more impactful, than his time spent peacefully connecting with plants.
I feel like I learned to just kind of appreciate life, just not really worry about things. Because, I don't know, I did like kind of burn alive for a couple of minutes. So I'm like, I feel like I've already experienced some like bad thing, so nothing probably would come close to that. I just feel like it just kind of put the world in a different perspective.
As for what all this means for the next camping trip, I don't know. If one of my friends decides to explore their inner wilderness, god trees, devils, and all, in the actual wilderness, that's their choice. All I can do is make sure they don't stray too far from camp.
That was Grant Hill reporting. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. You can find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Xavier Lopez is our associate producer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.